Thanks for downloading The Takeaway. This is Wednesday, November 1st, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you for being with us today. Tuesday afternoon, just a few blocks from our studios here at WNYC in Lower Manhattan, a man drove a pickup truck down a crowded bike path for almost a mile, striking several cyclists and killing eight people. 11 other people were injured. WNYC reporter Jim O'Grady was on the scene within 30 minutes, and he's here with me now in the studio. Jim, thanks for being here.
Sure, Todd.
I mentioned that this attack happened just a couple of blocks from here on the West Side Highway bike path. You were there very quickly. Tell us what you saw and what happened.
Well, by the time I got there, the police had already sealed off the scene, so we had to piece it together through eyewitnesses who had emerged from that area. And what we heard was Eugene Duffy, he's a chef. He works at a restaurant right next to the bike path. And we should let listeners know this is Lower Manhattan, a beautiful bike path going along the Hudson River. And he was leaving work. He heard a commotion, turned around, saw this van driving at high speed on the bike path, which is protected and off the roadway. And so it should not be happening. What he saw, to his mind, was a driver intent on killing people. He was driving at a high speed. He was going in a straight line. And this witness, Eugene Duffy, could hear bodies and bikes being mowed down. And then he heard or saw the truck crash into a school bus, heard shots, saw high school students fleeing. Stuyvesant High School is right there. And then he himself got out of there. I also spoke to a college student. Borough of Manhattan Community College is there. This guy was finishing up from studying. He was crossing a pedestrian path, looked down on the scene, and we heard this from several people, saw bodies, two of them. They were covered with blood, and they were not moving, and he said he stood there on the bridge and with tears coming out of his eyes.
Because it was one of the very terrifying incidents that I have ever watched, especially in this New York City, right? So, yeah, it was like very bad experience that I saw.
The suspect's been identified as Saifulo Saipov from Uzbekistan. He got out of the car, was shot by NYPD police, and then apprehended. Mm-hmm. What do we know about him?
Well, as of now, officials believe Saipov was living in New Jersey, and they say that's where he rented the Home Depot truck used in the attack. They say he's originally from Uzbekistan, and that's a post-Soviet republic that borders Afghanistan, and that he came to the U.S. legally in 2010. Yeah, as you say, he's now in critical condition after being shot in the abdomen. He's being held in a New York City hospital, though police won't say which one. And right now, the NYPD says it's working to sort out what motivates a man to mow down bikers and pedestrians the way he did.
Well, officials quickly labeled this a terrorist attack on Tuesday. Here's New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio just hours after the attack.
Let me be clear that based on the information we have at this moment, this was an act of terror. And a particularly cowardly act of terror.
And this morning, the counterterrorism chief of the NYPD, John Miller, shared more information at a press conference.
Based on the investigation overnight, it appears that Mr. Saipov had been planning this for a number of weeks. He did this in the name of ISIS, and along with the other items recovered at the scene was some notes that further indicate that.
New York City officials there. Jim, what do we know about the attack?
Well, initially they came to that conclusion that it is terrorist-inspired because witnesses and officers on the scene heard Saipov saying, "God is great," in Arabic. And now, of course, that alone is not proof of anything. But police are uncovering new evidence. They now say that Saipov left handwritten notes that said the Islamic State will endure forever. And that's significant because that phrase is considered a kind of calling card for ISIS-inspired attacks. In fact, last year, an ISIS magazine encouraged its followers to take trucks and do bodily harm to people in public places and said specifically, leave handwritten notes with that phrase. Other things we know is early this morning, FBI agents and police raided Saipov's apartment in Paterson, New Jersey, where he lived with his wife and two kids. And NYPD detectives have been collecting security video all along the highway that the suspect used before entering the bike path, killing eight people.
We've seen a pattern before after similar attacks in Europe and to some extent here in the United States, where investigators, if they suspect a connection to terrorism, try to piece together whether that's an ordered connection, part of a larger plot, or somebody who is inspired on the internet as sort of a lone wolf, may have had sympathies with ISIS, but was not in contact with them.
Yeah, that apparently seems to be the case. And, you know, just as an aside, what is the significance of the place he chose? It's in this bucolic stretch of an esplanade along the Hudson River. It's in the shadow of the World Trade Center. The attack went down at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a blue sky day that was eerily reminiscent of the weather during 9/11. And in fact, that area has been beautified since 9/11 and as a reaction to those terrorist attacks to sort of make it a place of life again. So one wonders, was the idea to take this beautiful place, one of the most beautiful places in all of New York City, and turn it into a place of horror?
And what about the reaction of New Yorkers who were around the scene?
So obviously people were stunned and upset on the scene. There's just flashing lights and everywhere, emergency vehicles, parents taking their children out of school and bringing them home. You could see that they were obviously shaken. On the other hand, it's a busy New York neighborhood. A lot of people live there. A lot of people work there. People were coming home from their jobs. They were stopping into the Whole Foods to get their dinner, let's say. And it was also Halloween. And the annual Greenwich Village Halloween Day Parade is a huge deal in New York City. Thousands of people go to it. So at the same time that this tragedy was unfolding, a few blocks away, I was watching Little Bo Peeps and Witches in Witch Hats, just kids trick-or-treating, people heading up to the parade. I interviewed a werewolf, Todd, and the werewolf told me that he was not going to let this, quote, ruin my day.
There was an increased police presence at the Halloween parade, but it went off as scheduled.
It went off as scheduled. It might have been a little less well-attended, but that certainly added to the surreal aspect of all this. You know, Governor Cuomo said what officials often say, get back to normal life, don't let this disrupt the life of a thriving city. And it seemed that that was occurring almost simultaneously with the attack itself, that people were going about their business. You know, it's sort of the power of daily life to resume its rhythms no matter what.
Jim O'Grady with WNYC on the scene of yesterday's attack on the West Side Highway bike path here in New York. Jim, thanks for coming in to update us.
Thank you, Todd.
As we mentioned earlier, officials are investigating the New York attack as an act of terrorism. With us to explain what's known about the suspect and where the investigation is likely to go from here, Karen Greenberg, director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School in New York. Karen, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What do we know now about the suspect, Saifullah Saipov, that's important to investigators and what they'll be looking at as they try to piece this crime, this alleged terror attack together?
We know when he entered the country in 2010. We know the various jobs that he's held as truck driver, as Uber driver. We probably know much more about his family and friends than we knew before. We knew he had a green card. They aren't telling us a lot about his network. I think that's intentional. So we don't know as much as we'd like to know right now.
Well, Karen, shortly after the incident happened on the West Side Highway bike path, politicians in New York and investigators were pretty quick to label this terrorism. Now investigators say they found notes at the scene pledging allegiance to ISIS, that they found information on his computer related to ISIS. So investigators will piece that together as well. But if investigators are treating this as a terror case, how is that different from just a crime? What does that difference mean to how they'll investigate and question Saipov, who they have in custody?
Since the last decade, actually, and notably with the underwear bomber, the Christmas Day bomber that was intercepted, the law enforcement has had a two-tier approach to interrogation with terrorism suspects, and they use it very sparingly. But what they do is they have intelligence officers and others talk to him first without having read him his Miranda rights, and then they read him his Miranda rights, and he's turned over to prosecutors and law enforcement, presumably for trial, or for prosecution if he wants to plead out. So that's what we can expect will happen here. They will get as much information from him as possible. They'll want to know who he was in contact with. Getting back to your other question, what he will be charged with, in this country, most terrorism suspects, and remember, we have very few attackers who have survived an attempted attack or an attack. So this is a rare case for us. We have the Boston bomber, and we have who succeeded in his attack. We have the Chelsea bomber who did not succeed in his attack here in New York. And they will be charged with a variety of counts of terrorism, including material support for terrorism. In most of these cases, officials try to prove a link between the defendant and a foreign terrorist organization. And as we have developed into the ISIS years, what that means to have a link to a foreign terrorist organization has become more and more amorphous. Because as you heard officials and law enforcement saying yesterday, what exactly does it mean that he said he was doing this on a note, or that the note said he was doing this in the name of ISIS? Exactly how tied to a foreign terrorist group do you have to be? And so that's one of the questions this will raise in the long term.
And we've seen this question from attacks not only here in the United States, as you mentioned, but also from similar attacks in London and across Europe, where investigators try to separate the idea of an attacker directed by ISIS, given marching orders or directions, told to go out and do an attack, versus someone who's inspired by the organization, reading the internet, and decides on their own to go out and execute an attack for the glory of the organization.
Right. I mean, self-radicalization is the persistent pattern among individuals who are indicted for and carry out ISIS attacks. And so how do you criminalize self-radicalization? What it's going to lead to is a different reading of the law. Material support, which used to be, you know, providing money, providing weapons, providing other things that could facilitate an attack or an attacker. Now, it is a very different thing to say these individuals are self-radicalized and have decided in their violent quest to tell themselves what to do and to order themselves what to do. So, yeah, that is a conversation I'm sure has been going on for since the beginning of these ISIS cases, which was 2014.
Karen, let's get back to the attack itself. What do you see in the apparently rudimentary nature of this attack? A small rented truck driven down a bike path at a high rate of speed, but no other weapons, apparently, at least that we know about, on the suspect's person. If he had guns, they may have been fake. A fairly simple and rudimentary attack.
Yeah, that's both the good news and the bad news. It's simple and rudimentary, meaning that it doesn't look like this was a big sell, a big plot. It doesn't look like this was necessarily directed and trained for in any sophisticated way. The bad news is how lethal it can be for anybody to just take something as simple as a vehicle and decide to ram down others, pedestrians or those on bikes. But what we have seen is this is the call that the ISIS online network has made, which is you need asking individuals who support ISIS to take something this unsophisticated. This is not the first time we've seen a rental truck involved in an attack. And so I think, you know, a lot of focus is going to be on how easy it is to rent a truck and who gets to, and are there penalties for those who rent trucks without thinking about who they're renting them to. Again, it can't be their responsibility, but that's the way law enforcement will begin to think about this.
Karen Greenberg, director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School in New York. Karen, thanks again.
Thank you.
Well, we followed the story all spring and summer long. You followed it right along with us. Republican attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act in Congress, which went through several different chapters and failed. And that means that Obamacare marches on. Open enrollment to get new Obamacare insurance plans starts today and runs through December 15th. Donna Rosato is senior editor for Consumer Reports, and she's here to answer some of your questions about picking a health plan under the ACA. Donna, thanks for being here.
Great to be with you.
Donna, we have lots of questions from listeners. We're going to get to them, but I have some questions of my own because many of us in Washington have watched the Trump administration make moves, both public and very subtle, that seem to be geared toward undermining enrollment, really discouraging people from enrolling in the Affordable Care Act, even though it is the law of the land. Do you see that happening, and is this going to be a difficult enrollment period because of that?
We do see that happening. There have been cutbacks in advertising to let people know that you can sign up. This program still exists. Funding for navigators who help people sign up was cut 40%. There's simply been a lot of confusion about whether people are required to sign up for the health insurance or be hit with a penalty, or even whether the ACA exchanges exist. And they do. But it is going to be one of the most difficult open enrollment periods that we've seen yet.
What's the point of the administration? Look, they have their political fights in Congress. We've watched that happen. What's the point of them using their power over advertising and navigators and the rest of it to discourage people from signing up?
Well, if you discourage people from signing up, then the insurers will have fewer people participating. They're going to have to cover a smaller pool of people instead of having a richer pool of people who may be healthier and less costly. And if you do that, well, one projection is that a million fewer people will sign up for ACA plans in 2018. That can lead to insurers leaving the market, premiums rising even more, and you will have fewer people with insurance. And if the goal is to undermine or get rid of the ACA exchanges, that can be an effective way to do it.
So that means that knowing your options and knowing what's available is more important than ever. We got lots of questions from listeners. Here's one listener from Austin, Texas.
This is Lynn Rapardo. I'd like to know how to choose a health care plan that will have a good catastrophic coverage. So if you get into a car accident or are diagnosed with some very serious illness, that your health care plan won't suddenly cut and run. And the next thing you know, they're responsible for tens and tens of thousands of bills, and they're too sick to deal with it.
She is right. People can be on the hook for tens and tens of thousands of dollars if their insurance doesn't adequately cover them. But that is one of the very important consumer protections that the Affordable Care Act created, which applies to every insurance plan, not just ACA plans, if you have employer plans. And here's what helps people in that situation. Every insurance plan now must cap your out-of-pocket cost, and there cannot be any limit, lifetime limit, on the amount of cost your insurer will cover. That was very common before the ACA took place. Now, the insurer must cover 100% of your covered costs. That has made a significant difference for people. The rate of personal bankruptcy has fallen significantly since the ACA took hold, because medical bills are one of the big drivers of bankruptcy. The thing to watch out for, and Lynn needs to understand this too, and all people need to understand this, you have to go to providers covered by your insurance. If you do what's called going out of network, all bets are off. You'll need to pay the full cost, and out-of-pocket limits don't apply.
We got this from Wisconsin that sounds like somebody who's fed up with their employer-based coverage and is thinking about going ACA, Donna. Are all available insurances in my state on healthcare.gov? Do I need to search other places for all of my options? More specific to me, why is my employer's insurance that they offer allowed to stink so much? Deductibles are so high you never use it. Anyone who actually uses healthcare regularly finds it's worse than useless.
You can choose to leave your employer insurance if you want, but if you decline your employer insurance, there are some downsides. You're not going to get federal subsidies that can help you pay your premiums, even if your income is low enough to qualify. But more important, employers pay a portion of your health insurance. And if you go to an ACA plan, your employer won't be kicking in anything. So you're going to be footing the whole bill. So it's not necessarily the best move to switch to an ACA plan. But if you don't like your employer plan, it is always worth checking out other options.
Let's hear from Allison, who has a question that's common to a lot of people who have health concerns before they buy their insurance.
I have certain health conditions that require specific medications, which are not always covered by insurance plans. Is there a way that I can find out whether specific medications are covered by a plan that I'm interested in purchasing?
Donna, they sometimes call that the formulary. Can Allison go somewhere and find out the formulary for any ACA plan she's interested in before buying?
Yes, and this is a really good question. People often don't realize that your insurance plan won't cover every prescription medication, and insurance companies have what is known, as you said, as a formulary. That's just the list of prescription drugs, both generic and brand name, that they'll cover. And if you choose a drug that is not covered by the formulary, you're going to have to pay for full price for yourself. Now, insurance companies consult with medical professionals to identify the drugs they deem offer the greatest value. So it's not a random decision that, you know, one drug will be covered by the formulary versus another. It's about safety and the efficacy of the drug, but it is about value and cost too. So many companies won't cover brand name drugs, for example, but the generic or less expensive version. But for Allison, you know, the important thing, and for others too, to know is that that formulary, what your insurer covers every year, can change. So to check, it's very easy. This is the good news. Most insurance companies publish on their website what drugs that they cover online. So just go to your insurer's website and you can find that out. If you're confused and this is job-based insurance, your employer should be able to tell you as well. But that is information that's easy to find out as long as you know to look for it.
The Affordable Care Act does still exist, but you might have to do a little bit more homework to find out what plans are available to you during open enrollment, which starts today, lasts through December 15th. Donna Rosato, Senior Editor for Consumer Reports, we appreciate you stopping by to help out.
Thank you so much.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. We return now to the fallout over Monday's indictments by special counsel Robert Mueller. Tony Podesta, the founder of the D.C. lobbying firm The Podesta Group, has left the company, all after accusations the group lobbied on behalf of some of the same pro-Russian Ukrainian parties Paul Manafort helped. No charges have been brought against Tony Podesta, his brother John Podesta, or the firm they founded together in 1988, but their work for the European Center for Modern Ukraine has caught the attention of Robert Mueller's investigators. It's likely the true identity of a lobbying firm referred to in Paul Manafort's indictment. Betsy Woodruff is a politics reporter for the Daily Beast. Betsy, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Betsy, we've seen the indictments against Rick Gates and Paul Manafort already, and the charges are well known by now. Money laundering, conspiracy against the United States, hiding assets, using offshore accounts, and the rest of it. But what do the unsealed indictments say about the Podesta Group specifically?
They don't specifically mention the Podesta Group by name. Instead, they refer to two lobbying firms only as Company A and Company B. But reporters were able to conclude with a high degree of certainty within a few hours of the indictment coming down that Company A and Company B referred to the Podesta Group and Mercury LLC, another lobbying firm. What the indictment indicates is that the Podesta Group worked closely with Paul Manafort, that they followed directions that were given to Paul Manafort by Viktor Yanukovych, the authoritarian pro-Putin president of Ukraine, and that the Podesta Group essentially did the bidding of Yanukovych by pushing his talking points and his policy ideas to members of the media in Washington, D.C., as well as to members of Congress and Capitol Hill staffers.
So this basically says that while Paul Manafort is in Ukraine helping Viktor Yanukovych, his political party and his government with their pro-Putin policies, he's using Podesta Group and this other lobbying firm back home to take those ideas and to push the Yanukovych agenda in front of Congress, in front of the White House, in front of Washington.
Exactly. That's what the indictment alleges. And one thing the indictment isn't crystal clear about, but that it hints at, is that the Podesta Group and Mercury LLC appear to potentially have known who they were working for. Now, part of the reason this information is so important is that while the Podesta Group was lobbying essentially on behalf of Viktor Yanukovych, it did not disclose to the Justice Department that it was working for a foreign government. Instead, it only made a limited, vague disclosure to Congress. Now, it's a crime not to disclose to the Justice Department if you're lobbying for a foreign government. The Podesta Group's defense, which they rolled out over the last few months in the press, is that they didn't know that they were actually working on behalf of Yanukovych. But the indictment includes emails and information which alleges, does not prove, but it certainly suggests, that the two lobbying firms mentioned in the indictment, Mercury LLC and the Podesta Group, may have been aware that they were working for foreign political leaders. And what this all points to, though, is the toothlessness with which the Justice Department currently enforces that foreign lobbying law. So what we're seeing with the indictment against Manafort is potentially a renewed aggressiveness behind enforcement of that law that bars American lobbying firms from secretly working for foreign governments. And the fact that the indictment specifically mentions the Podesta Group and Mercury LLC raises some big questions. Are we going to see federal law enforcement authorities go after Mercury LLC and the Podesta Group?
We're talking with Betsy Woodruff of The Daily Beast about the role of the Podesta Group in this week's Mueller indictments. Betsy, what this looks like from the outside, from your reporting and from the indictment itself, is that the Podesta Group had plausible deniability here. You know, we didn't know we were working for a foreign government. Meanwhile, money is coming in from offshore accounts, presumably put there by Paul Manafort. Viktor Yanukovych doesn't write you a check. Therefore, you can claim that you didn't know you were working for foreign interests.
Exactly. And that's something the Podesta Group has claimed emphatically over the last few months, ever since the news started trickling out that they worked hand in hand with Manafort on behalf of the Yanukovych government. Ultimately, if federal law enforcement officials bring charges against the Podesta Group, which is a very big if, just to be clear to listeners, if they bring those charges, a jury will have to decide. Should the Podesta Group have known better? Did the Podesta Group know better? Or was this lobbying firm that has been operating for decades, that's incredibly sophisticated, that bills its clients high prices, that has a ton of lawyers on staff, was this lobbying firm just innocently duped by a foreign government? That's something a jury would have to determine if federal law enforcement officials bring charges.
Betsy, let's take a step back from the indictment itself for just one second. What does this whole story tell us about the nature of lobbying at this level in Washington, D.C.? I mean, what you're describing is not only potentially, allegedly, kind of a scheme of plausible deniability to make millions of dollars while representing a foreign government without claiming it, but also, this is a firm that was founded by John Podesta and his brother, helping Paul Manafort, who becomes Donald Trump's campaign manager. John Podesta turns around and is one of the most powerful Democrats in Washington and is the chairman of the Clinton campaign. Meanwhile, everybody's making money together.
Exactly. And what this story lays out in a way that's just crystal clear is how incestuous Washington, D.C.'s lobbying community is. Foreign governments that have money and that are looking to influence American policymakers will be able to hire lobbyists all across the political divide. One thing that ends partisanship, that truly brings people together in Washington, is cash. Even if it's cash that comes from an authoritarian political party that's allied with Vladimir Putin. And of course, the irony here couldn't be richer. You had Viktor Yanukovych using a lobbying firm that was founded by Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman, and at the same time using a political operative, Paul Manafort, who went on to run Donald Trump's campaign. Yanukovych was in sort of this amazing spot of being able to hire lobbying firms associated with one of the most powerful Republicans in Washington and one of the most powerful Democrats in Washington. When it came to making significant sums of money to try to influence the media and politicians on Capitol Hill, partisan divides vanished, and Republicans and Democrats were happy to work together. So when politicians say, we can't work with Republicans, we can't work with Democrats on issues like tax reform and immigration policy and health care, it's important for listeners to remember that while those issues might have partisan divides that policymakers claim are just insurmountable, an authoritarian leader of a pro-Putin party in Ukraine was able to get Washington insiders to ignore their partisan divides. That might be something that would put pressure on policymakers to potentially show a similar level of bipartisanship.
Betsy Woodruff with The Daily Beast. Betsy, always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Last week, Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman vowed to return the country to moderate Islam, saying, quote, what happened in the last 30 years is not Saudi Arabia. Internally, there have been moves to relieve Saudi Arabia of the markings of an ultra-conservative theocracy. One example, a recent decision to rescind the ban on women driving cars. Meanwhile, externally, Saudi Arabia is trying to soften its image around the world, in part through a cultural exchange program with an American think tank. Here's Deirdre Evans-Pritchard of the Middle East Institute.
I mean, the stated intention is to show people who are successful in Saudi Arabia to the United States.
The Middle East Institute was contracted by a Saudi cultural organization called the King Abdulaziz Center, and that center is funded by the Saudi state oil company Saudi Aramco. The goal of these arrangements? To bring a number of young Saudi professionals to the United States, set up talks, performances, and events, and project an image of Saudi modernity to the world. One of the people on that exchange program is Saudi rapper Kusay. He's also the host of the Saudi TV show Arabs Got Talent. Kusay was born in Saudi Arabia, then he moved to the United States for college before returning home. I caught up with him when he was in Orlando, Florida, promoting his music, but we wound up talking about how and why Kusay was touring the United States.
This time I am part of this cultural program with the King Abdulaziz Center for World Culture. As an ambassador for hip-hop, representing my country and representing Arabic hip-hop.
Is that funded through the Saudi government?
I would say yes. Yeah, you could say that.
I mean, what does it feel like to do hip-hop, to do art, but under the auspices of a government, under the auspices of a state?
It feels great that my country finally approved of the hip-hop music and the hip-hop culture, and I've been doing it for many, many years. And ever since my first hit in 2007, 2008, we're talking about a decade later that they finally approved of hip hop. And here I am being part of this program with the center and here representing hip hop. And it's beautiful to be back in Orlando where I lived and I graduated from.
All right, Kusay, you were born in Saudi Arabia. How did you first discover hip hop? What were you listening to as a kid?
When I was a little kid, I was a music lover. You know, I used to listen to the greats, from Michael Jackson to Prince, to name a few. Later on in the late 80s, early 90s, I heard this track by LL Cool J. Said, Mama Said Knock You Out. I don't know if you're familiar with it or not.
Of course, of course.
Don't call it a comeback. I've been here for years. I'm rocking my pants. Put suckers in fear.
I was like, what is this? This is great music, but he's not singing. He's talking. He's rapping in poetry. So I got more into the culture of the fact that my parents and my family used to travel a lot and to the States. And when they came back, they used to bring all this music and the vinyls and the records. And I used to listen to them. And the journey started right there.
There's a lot of imagery in hip hop. There's a lot of ideas in hip hop that I would think from a distance don't really play in Saudi Arabia.
I agree. I mean, hip hop started to be in Saudi Arabia only available in the stores where you can purchase the tapes back then. There wasn't even no CDs, and I'm talking early 90s. Later on, here comes the CDs. But by 1996, I was out. I moved to the States to pursue my education. And when I came back, things were different. You know, the internet has opened the doors. You got to see so many hip-hop artists from all around the Middle East. And you're starting to notice that there is a hip-hop scene in Saudi Arabia, but it's underground. Plus, there is no support and there is no outlet.
Does that mean that hip hop and other art like it essentially is censored?
Absolutely. It is censored.
All right. So what does that mean for you as an artist? Because you're now operating not only on the world stage in a big way, but through the center funded by the Saudi government. That has to be a conflict for an artist like you.
Well, you can say that because, you know, hip hop itself is a very expressive art. But with respect to my culture, the heritage, the ethics and all that stuff, I understand how far I can take it. And I can speak about some certain things that's related to my culture. And I don't attack social issues. I address social issues because I am part of my society and the people and in the streets with respect to my country and everything.
So you have one track called Salam, which means peace, of course.
Hey yo, put your peace sign up in the air. It's time to wake up, cause nowadays we don't care about our old race, humanity, mankind. And the power of politics has washed our minds. Greed became the weapon, so they bomb and kill the blood of innocent children with a free will. So fight the power, lend a helping hand. One nation united, under God we stand.
You say fight the power. Here in America, that sort of means you're a subversive. You're willing to fight power. Is that what you are?
It depends on that power. If the power is representing nothing but corruption and negativity, then we should fight that, regardless. We're not talking violence. We're talking about standing with each other, hand in hand, with peace.
Do you feel a responsibility, or have you addressed extremism in the Arab world, or even coming from Saudi Arabia? Is that a thing that you feel like you should address?
I would say, yeah, I should, but I know my limitations and how far I go. But in the United States, you guys have the freedom of expression. We don't have freedom of expression in Saudi Arabia. We have these limits that you can reach, but this is as far as you go because you have to respect the culture, the religion, the tradition, and the ethics and the morals. And I value that. I value that so much. That made me the person I am today.
It's so hard for an American.
It is.
It's hard for an American to hear that, Kusei, or a journalist or any American to say, you know, you've spent a lot of time in this country. You value freedom of expression. You know what the First Amendment is. And you go back to your own country and you're willing to operate in a world where it doesn't exist. It's a tough one.
It is a tough one, especially for any artist, period. But later on, you're going to get used to it. And then after that, people will understand where you're coming from.
It sounds to me like you really stay away from politics, don't you?
I stay away from politics completely. I'm not a politician. I am a musician. I'm an artist. And first and foremost, I am a human being. Politics is not my field. It's not my area. And to be honest, I don't get involved in it a lot.
What's it like for you being a traditional, pretty religious Muslim man in America, being a Saudi man in America right now?
Simply, I'm just being me, representing where I'm from. I'm just a guest.
Just a guest in America, meaning you don't take a position or you don't internalize.
And an ambassador and a representative of my country in a good way, in a positive way.
Kusei, also known as Don Legend, the Chameleon. Great to have you.
The pleasure is mine, Todd.
We just heard from Saudi rapper Kusei, who, as we mentioned, is in the United States as part of a cultural exchange through the King Abdulaziz Center for World Culture in Saudi Arabia. It's part of a larger push by the Saudi government to project a new image around the world. Paul Cochran is a former contributing editor for Arab Media and Society. He says Saudi Arabia has been pushing this type of soft power for years, and they're not the only country to do it. But there's been a new emphasis on getting those ideas filtered through American think tanks.
I mean, what it's been trying to do for decades, really, and it's really upped in the last several years, is to really try and sort of portray a more cultured, softer version of the kingdom, rather than it being, you know, a hardcore Islamic society. And because a lot of media is not allowed to operate so easily and freely within Saudi Arabia, there's sort of restricted images that we can see or stories coming out. So they want to control that story within Saudi Arabia, but also in how it's projected and pushed outside of the kingdom.
Now, this must have become much more important, however, to the Saudis after 9/11, right, where public opinion in the United States turned sharply against the kingdom. So this type of soft power, positive image push must have become critical to them.
Yes. You know, 9/11 was a real turning point. I mean, the Saudis were put under so much pressure and really under the spotlight, and that's not gone away. And I mean, on the media front, they've really pushed things forward from after 2001, really. I mean, the satellite channel Al Arabiya was started in 2003. It was set up by people closely linked to the royal family. And it was set up to counter Al Jazeera, which was set up in 1996. And Al Jazeera is from Qatar. So, I mean, it was expanding to sort of cover the whole gamut, shall we say, from entertainment to news. And we saw this a lot with the Arab uprisings, the Arab Spring. Al Arabiya, I mean, Saudi media, really took sides on that. I mean, you see the big demonstrations that happened in Bahrain. The Saudis didn't cover it. And then on the other side, you know, that they do a lot of investigation reports on regimes that they were opposed to, like the Syrian government or the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. So it's, I mean, like in many state-influenced or owned medias, it shows the negatives and the positive situation that it wants to show and overlooks what could sort of harm its agenda.
Paul, in the interview before this conversation, we spoke to a Saudi rapper named Kusay. He described himself as a cultural ambassador for the King Abdulaziz Center. It's an art center funded by the state-run oil company, Saudi Aramco. What is the King Abdulaziz Center, and how does it fit into the broader Saudi program of shaping the cultural and media narrative of their country?
Right, the King Abdulaziz Center for World Culture was opened in 2016 in Dhahran, which is in the east of the kingdom. That's where most of the oil is located. It's also where the headquarters of Aramco is, and they fully funded the center. It's one of these, I guess you could call it sort of a white elephant in some way, sort of entities that litter the Gulf. And they're invariably commissioned by world-renowned architects. But it's in many ways window dressing. It's showing a positive image of the kingdom. So in the U.S., when you have the rapper coming there and talking and being a cultural ambassador, people think, great, wow, they have rappers in Saudi Arabia. You know, this is not what you'd expect. And so it's a good way to sort of show that you are more cosmopolitan and open than you really are.
So Kusay came to us through a group called the Middle East Institute, which said they were partnering with the Abdulaziz Center to bring Saudi cultural figures like Kusay to America in a new pilot project. We spoke to Deirdre Evans-Pritchard from the Middle East Institute and asked her about what they were up to.
So we are contracted. We are under contract, okay, to deliver an exchange program for them, which involves bringing 30 social movers and thinkers in the arts and cultural world to the United States. And we are part of more than one program in the United States. And the program is now branded as Bridges. And if you go to the King Abdulaziz Center, you should find that branding up there.
So, Paul, they call it Bridges, and that's what helped bring rapper Kusay to us and to American audiences. We should be fair. The United States has done this kind of cultural seeding and cultural ambassadorship, whatever you want to call it, for decades. I mean, we've been doing this since the Cold War to project our image around the world.
Yeah, I mean, so many countries do as well. I mean, the French Cultural Institute's very big in a lot of countries, particularly the Francophone ones, the British Council. It's really a common sort of thing to reach out and tell other people about your culture. You know, that sort of soft power sort of approach that works fairly well to quite a degree. I mean, if you look at MBS, Mohammed bin Salman saying lately, you know, he wants to reform and do all these things. And at the same time, in the last few months, you've had dozens of people arrested, dissidents. I mean, that includes poets. I mean, and they wouldn't have, the Saudi state wouldn't have let any sort of rapper go to represent them in the U.S. You know, Kusay was sort of chosen because he was the right sort of candidate. He wouldn't have been doing things that would have been really against the monarchy or the regime or being overly political. And anybody that doesn't go along with their sort of version, they wouldn't be a cultural ambassador.
Paul, we asked Deirdre Evans-Pritchard of the Middle East Institute about just how much money was coming in their partnership with the Abdulaziz Center. Listen.
And you mentioned that you were contracted. I mean, are you getting funding for this?
Well, yes, that's what a contract is.
Can you give me a figure of how much?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
I'm actually astonished you would ask that kind of question.
That's Takeaway producer Oliver Lazarus speaking to Deirdre Evans-Pritchard. Paul, she's astonished that we would ask a question like that. Are you astonished that she wouldn't answer it?
No, unless I'm not. I mean, she was very blunt. I mean, that's quite surprising, sort of, and astonished to ask the question. I mean, you know, a lot of these think tanks and organizations are supposed to be transparent, particularly where their funding comes from, and especially if it comes from a foreign government. But, I mean, this has been going on for years now within think tanks and other institutions. And particularly, I mean, in the last several years, the Gulf states and Saudi have been really active in this. It's sort of been an explosion, should we say, of think tank funding. I mean, it's not just in the U.S. It's also in the U.K. It's within think tanks and organizations within the Middle East or in the Gulf itself that the Gulfies or those want to attract. And this is affecting their credibility in many ways and their objectivity. Because they're not going to do critical things or do critical research about the Gulf countries as a result. I mean, and quite a few of the allegations and the money that they've been getting has been published a bit recently, and it's in the millions.
Paul Cochran, former contributing editor for Arab Media and Society. Paul, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, you heard from the Middle East Institute a few moments ago. They've since shared with us their list of contributions from 2016. It includes $281,000 for an exchange program from TAM Development LLC. They're the funder of the Saudi program, as well as $2 million from the Saudi Arabia Ministry of Foreign Affairs for a Gulf Studies program, and $200,000 in unrestricted funds from Saudi Aramco. The Middle East Institute also told us, we place a great deal of value on maintaining a reputation for nonpartisanship, independent research, and analysis. We do not advocate for any one policy or position. Well, as Paul said, it's increasingly common for American think tanks to get large sums of money from foreign governments. Experts from those think tanks can end up quoted in the media or on shows like this. And it's a good reminder for all of us to question sources of funding and how they might impact the messages we hear on the air and in our media. Well, nobody funds what you have to say when you call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway, so be sure to do it. That's all for us today. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.